This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, we talk more about the Drug Enforcement Administration's decision to not remove marijuana from its list of most dangerous drugs. And we briefly discuss some of the nefarious history behind the government's long crackdown on dope smokers.
And Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump may both be opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but Barack Obama is still president and he still wants to see the trade deal passed, damn it. We report on his latest maneuvering to pass the TPP.
And also to those who like fast and cheap internet, the courts are trying to screw you. We discussed a decision last week that hampers communities who want to offer decent internet to underserved residents.
But first, who's ready for another multi-millionaire in the White House? I know I am.
That's not a reference to Donald Trump not actually having $1 billion, is it?
Well, we may never know, actually.
We may never know. That's true.
On that note, at the end of last week, Hillary Clinton released her tax returns showing that she and her husband, Bill, made $10.6 million last year. Almost half of it was earned by Bill Clinton through speaking fees, you know, getting on that that speech game, getting on that speech circuit. Very lucrative. Hillary earned another $1 million via speaking fees as well last year. She also earned $3 million in book sales, and Bill Clinton earned over $1.5 million doing consulting work. Now, $10.6 million is a lot less money than what the Clintons earned in 2014. Then they earned $28 million, but hey, when you have to get off that speaking circuit to go run for president, you tend not to collect as much income from it. Remember, one of the big sticking points during the primary were all the speeches that Clinton gave to Goldman in the year prior.
Didn't she say that she only accepted $250,000 from Goldman because she didn't know at the time that she was eventually going to run for president?
I actually think the reason she said she accepted $250,000 from Goldman is because that's what they offered.
I think she said both of those things for the record.
And we can pretty much discount the latter, her saying, well, I didn't know I was going to run for president, as complete bunk. But
yeah,
who knows? Also revealed in the Clinton tax returns, they gave a little more than $1 million to charity, their own charities, by the way, including financing a charity golf tournament hosted by Bill Clinton. I didn't get the invite to that. Still, hey, look, $10.6 million in earnings, that ain't bad. I'd take it. The Clintons' tax returns also show they paid an effective federal tax rate of 34.2%. If you include state and local taxes, they paid upwards of 43%. That's more than I was expecting. Clinton's running mate Tim Kaine also released his tax returns showing much more meager household earnings. His family made $313,000 last year.
Poor guy.
Yeah, poor guy. They paid an effective tax rate of around 20%. Now, although it's customary for presidential candidates to release their tax returns, as Clinton did here, there's another very obvious reason for why she's released them, and that is to pressure Donald Trump into releasing his tax returns, which he says he won't do because he's being audited, even though the IRS has no rules preventing people who are being audited from releasing their tax returns. Trump also refuses to release evidence that he's actually being audited. So just to kind of hammer home this point that Clinton releasing her tax returns is all about also pressuring Trump to release his, here's a web ad that the Clinton campaign cut alongside releasing her tax returns that features a host of Republicans calling on Trump to do the same.
We will only really know if he's a real deal or a phony if he releases his tax returns.
For the last 30 or 40 years, every candidate for president has released their tax returns, and I think Donald Trump should as well.
He doesn't want to do it, because presumably there's something in there that is bad.
That's perhaps one more reason why we're not seeing his tax returns, because he is deeply involved in dealing with Russian oligarchs.
Either he's not anywhere near as wealthy as he says he is, or he hasn't been paying the kind of taxes we would expect him to pay, or perhaps he hasn't been giving money to the vets or to the disabled like he's been telling us he's been doing.
Well, there he is. A fairly effective ad, I guess, if you assume that Republican voters who support Trump would listen to what Mitt Romney and Mitch McConnell and George Will have to say.
Yeah, I was going to say that that started and ended with Mitt Romney, at least what we cut from it there. That's we saw what happened to Mitt Romney earlier in the campaign when he tried to take on Trump. It was very ineffective.
Yes. So that ad was put out there by the Clinton campaign, which, by the way, is outspending, by far and away, outspending the Trump campaign on ads, mainly because the Trump campaign hasn't spent a dime on ads yet. Talked about that last week, how the Trump campaign is currently being outspent by Jill Stein of the Green Party, as well as Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party on ads. Of course, anyone can outspend you when you spend nothing. But look, Trump has a bigger problem than the tax return stuff. He's hemorrhaging supporters right now. There's a pretty revealing report in The Guardian published last Friday showing that people are growing more and more fed up with Donald's shtick. And by people, I mean his own supporters. Here's what The Guardian did. They interviewed 100 Trump supporters back in February in the middle of the GOP primary, and they published 12 responses from those interviews, people explaining why they supported Trump.
And they did it anonymously, right?
Right.
They were,
right. And these people who they interviewed gave reasons like they were concerned about radical Muslims, which is why they're supporting Trump. They were concerned about the PC culture, politically correct culture.
Also why they were anonymous for those two reasons.
You don't want to go on record saying that stuff, to be honest. They viewed Trump as anti-establishment, someone who could shake things up, reveal the corruption and cronyism in Washington. Some people preferred his economic policies. And there was even people who went on and said that they wanted to heighten the contradictions. They didn't really like Trump, but they think he'll bring about revolution, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that stuff always works out.
Yeah, it works out great. So these were some of the reasons that these Trump supporters gave back in February. Well, The Guardian caught up with these 12 people now after the primary, now into the general election, and after Trump has arguably said even more problematic things on the campaign trail. Actually, take that back. Before February, he said a lot of problematic things about Mexicans and about Muslims. So, well, to be honest, if you didn't have a problem with him back then, you shouldn't have a problem with him now. But it turns out people actually do have a problem with him now.
I don't know. Maybe they thought he would moderate, you know, while pivoting to the general. You know, back in February, that wasn't such a wild idea.
Yeah, true. So I guess what I should say is, The Guardian caught up with these people now that it's clear that Trump isn't moderating.
He's doubled, tripled, quadrupled down and such.
Yeah. And what The Guardian found is that of the 12 supporters they interviewed in February, a third of them were no longer supporting Trump. And I'm just going to read some of the quotes that these people gave explaining why they've jumped off the Donald train. At first, I was seduced by his showmanship and strongman persona and charisma, and by his strong borders patriotism and willingness to speak about the problems with Islam and considering banning all Muslims from coming into the USA, said a 40-year-old scientist from California. Anyways, he goes on to say, but when he said the judge of Mexican heritage wouldn't be fair in his lawsuit and women should be punished for having abortions, that really turned me off him. Well, again, I don't want to criticize these people too much, but if you didn't have a problem with the outright ban on Muslims entering the country, I'm not sure why you have a problem with some harsh words for Mexican judges, but whatever. Here's another one. A 66-year-old retired biomedical engineer said, quote, Trump has demonstrated that he is much more than a narcissistic buffoon. Anyone who is willing to put the trigger for America's nuclear weapons in the hands of someone like this is placing the future of human civilization at risk. I believe we must do anything to prevent Trump from ever reaching the Oval Office, even if it means voting for Hillary Clinton.
Can I just want to jump in here real quick. You just mentioned two former Trump supporters that the one of them was an engineer, biomedical engineer, and the other was a scientist. And it just very delightfully reminds me of a New Yorker piece by George Packer from March on Tunisians joining the Islamic State. And I just want to very quickly read through this passage here. A friend of Mohammed's, an unemployed telecommunications engineer named Nabil Saliti, left his town to fight in Syria. Usama Romdani, who edits the Arab Weekly in Tunis, told me that in the Arab world, the most likely radicals are people in technical or scientific fields who lack the kind of humanities education that fosters critical thought. Before Saliti left, Mohammed asked him why he was going off to fight. Saliti replied, "I can't build anything in this country, but the Islamic State gives us the chance to create, to build bombs, to use technology." In July 2013, Saliti blew himself up in a suicide bombing in Iraq. The point that I want to make here, I guess, is that science, technology, engineering, and math students, the so-called STEM guys, well, all over the world, they are attracted to medieval strongmen, whether it is Donald Trump or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So, folks, be sure to support the liberal arts, support liberal arts and humanities educations. Thank you.
And that concludes your PSA for today. Reading a few more of what these Trump supporters, let me just say, this last Trump supporter, he went from believing in Trump, supporting Trump, and then in 5 months, believing that Trump will put all of human civilization at risk. Anyways, well, going back to your theory here about STEM guys being more likely to support strongmen, I've got a little bad news for it. Because this next former Trump supporter almost surely has a liberal arts degree.
Uh-oh.
It's a 29-year-old yoga teacher. Anyways, they told The Guardian this about her change of heart. Quote, "What does bother me is Trump's authoritarian tendencies. I believe it would be safe to assume he will grow the American police and surveillance states, which are already spiraling out of control." This person, fitting the bill of a 29-year-old yoga teacher, says they're going to vote for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson.
How do you just now realize he has authoritarian tendencies, though? I mean,
yeah, did you watch any of The Apprentice? The whole show was modeled off him being an authoritarian.
Right. Or, you know, in February before, when you said you were going to vote for him, when you didn't think this authoritarian thing was a problem, you know, I don't know, weeks after he said he wanted to ban all Muslims from entering the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Another former Trump supporter is now telling The Guardian that Trump, quote, seems to be insane. "I no longer believe it is possible that he could truly represent the people who support him and need what he promised."
I almost spit out my coffee there. That was.
Again, in just 5 months, we went from people saying Trump is great, Trump is the guy who's going to fix this country, to Trump is insane and is a risk to the future of mankind.
But yeah, 6 months ago, he would have been the best commander in chief.
Yeah. So look, this isn't a scientific poll or anything, but these are real people, and people tend to act like other real people. So out of a sample size of 12, if a third of them are jumping off the Trump train, you can bet that there are more people who are wavering in this election.
Just real quick, there were two people as well who didn't respond to The Guardian's request for a follow-up. So yeah. I think it's more like 4 out of 10.
Yes, 4 out of 10.
Waiting for the other two. But yeah. Even assuming they're still voting Trump. Yeah, you're right.
And one of the people who appear to be seeing the writing on the wall that the Trump campaign might be doomed is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. McConnell is growing more concerned that he may lose his job as majority leader if Trump decimates down ballot Republicans running for Congress in November. He said, quote, "I may or may not be calling the shots next year," McConnell told a group in Louisville late last week. McConnell added that Republicans' chances to retain the Senate are, quote, "very dicey." So he was talking to fundraisers, so maybe he was just trying to scare them into making some more contributions. I notice I've received some emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign saying, "Hey, we're losing. We could very much lose this. Give us money."
Yeah.
I don't know. Or maybe Mitch McConnell is genuinely afraid that Trump is imploding and that he may take the party with him.
Both of those things could be true.
Yeah. And look, I'll be the first to admit, I'm genuinely surprised by how much of a disaster the Trump campaign is proving to be here. I said on this show before that I think this election is going to be close. On paper, after Trump ripped through the GOP primary carrying a populist anti-trade message, running against the mistakes of the Bush administration, painting Hillary Clinton as a tool of Wall Street. I figured he'd at least put up a bigger fight in the general than Mitt Romney was able to do in 2012. And 2012 was just determined by a handful of swing states. And if Trump could outperform Romney in those swing states, this election could actually be close. And again, just three weeks ago, before he went on to attack the Kahn family, and before he went on to make his Second Amendment comments, and before he went on to say that President Obama founded ISIS, literally founded ISIS, and then doubled down on it, saying, no, I meant he literally founded ISIS, Trump was up in the polls in these swing states. Since then, it's looking more and more like this thing could be just an absolute blowout. Here's a few of the latest polling numbers here. Clinton now leads Trump in battleground states of Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, and Colorado. In fact, Clinton leads by a whopping 14 points in Colorado, 46% to 32%. Wow. And he leads by 13 points in Virginia, 46% to 33%. Look, polls also show that Clinton is up in Pennsylvania. She's up in Ohio. She's up in Iowa. We talked about how she is showing that she's polling in red states, that she should have no chance of winning in Utah.
In Arizona,
in Georgia.
Mississippi, I saw it was close, that it's within reach in Mississippi.
Exactly. And now that Egg McMuffin is jumping in the race, it could really screw Donald Trump in Utah. Look, all I'm saying is if these polls hold up, if she wins all these states, this election is indeed over, folks. More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, where the two Sams are still here with you from Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., where it seems like most talk about the financial sector is already behind us this year in the presidential campaign, with Bernie Sanders vanquished in the general election between a Wall Street-friendly Democrat and a fake populist billionaire Republican. It doesn't seem likely we will hear much about breaking up the banks or strong regulatory initiatives between now and November. But because we here care deeply about banking regulations, and because the hyper-financialized banker overlord economy isn't going anywhere anytime soon, we wanted to chat today about the state of financial regulation, so we brought on journalist David Dayan. David is the author of Chain of Title, a book on the subprime mortgage crisis and the wave of fraudulent foreclosures it spawned. And he is a journalist who has written extensively in a lot of places on the issue and more broadly on financial regulation, including two recent articles in The Intercept, which we are going to focus on today. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam.
Thanks for coming on and for referring to us as the Sams, as we like to be known.
It's just easier.
So let's start with your most recent piece, which was published on Thursday. The Federal Reserve is one of the more secretive institutions in Washington, and to some extent it has to be, given that it doesn't want to tip off investors about interest rate decisions. But after reading your last story, I gotta say, it does kind of seem like that every single conspiracy theory that I've ever heard about the Fed is true. At least it seems like that. Can you explain to our listeners what happened in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in the run-up to a Fed conference there later this month?
Yeah, this is a really strange one. So every year, the Kansas City Federal Reserve, one of the regional banks, puts on this annual event in Jackson Hole. And usually the chair of the Fed speaks at it, and all of these big hitters globally and nationally get together, economists, central bankers, to talk about the economy. It's one of these major gatherings for economists. And the last 2 years, this group called Fed Up, which is a campaign of low-wage workers, community activists, communities of color, have crashed the party. They have gone to this event in 2014 and 2015 to try to, you know, pressure the Fed to say, when you're thinking about raising interest rates, when you're thinking about doing measures that may impact the economy, think about us too. Don't just think about wealthy financiers or people on Wall Street. think about all of the workers in the country and how they are doing before you take steps that are going to really impact their financial and economic lives. So they've done this the last 2 years, and the Fed Up campaign has showed up, and they plan to show up again this year. And then a couple weeks before this event, which is in late August, they get a call from the lodge that they booked their tickets at, and apparently there was a quote-unquote computer glitch, and their 13 reservations were just canceled, basically. And this puts the Fed Up campaign in quite a spot, because now they'll have to get alternative accommodations many, many miles away. They won't have the sort of coziness of bumping into, you know, central bankers in the hallway and trying to, you know, tell them their stories. The campaign has filed a civil rights claim. They really believe that this is because of who they are, that they were taken out. There was the glitch apparently was supposed to have overbooked the lodge by 18 rooms. And so the 13 of the 18 cancellations were fell upon the Fed Up campaign, even though they booked ahead of hundreds of other rooms. This is a 385-room facility. And they booked first in front of a lot of other people who are being able to stay this weekend, which is obviously a critical, a very busy weekend. So it's one of these very strange episodes that shows the sort of insular nature, secrecy of these large central bank gatherings, and certainly it raises some questions about them.
Yeah, I wonder how many Fed officials were notified that their rooms were lost too as a result of the booking glitch.
I think the answer approaches zero. I don't know the exact number, but from what I understand, the National Park Service is actually a public facility that is on the grounds of Grand Teton National Park. It's managed by a private company, but it is a public facility. They are looking into the matter, the Grand Teton National Park. The National Park Service. They were also informed about this, along with the Department of the Interior and the Department of Justice. So we'll see what happens. But it does have some. It just seems like there's some shenanigans going on here.
Yeah, it certainly does. And we can certainly ascribe a motive, perhaps, to any potential wrongdoing here. But I wanted to ask: is there any? Is there any evidence that Fed Up have been getting under the skin of Fed officials?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that they have found some success, at least within the Democratic Party, in terms of this pressure campaign. You know, this comes at an interesting time because one of the things Fed Up has been talking about is the lack of diversity in the Federal Reserve, the fact that no African-American has ever been the president of a regional Federal Reserve bank, the fact that most of the staff and most of the heads of the regional banks and the boards of directors and the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is white and male and largely comes from the financial sector. And they've been not only just writing about this themselves, but they've received support from hundreds of members of the Democratic caucus, and even Hillary Clinton. And in fact, there is language in the Democratic platform that says that we need to stop having bankers sit on the boards of these regional Federal Reserve banks who regulate then those banks. So there's definitely, they've been making some headway. And this is kind of interesting because, we think about protests against the Fed as coming exclusively from sort of the Ron Paul right. But this is one that has really come from the left and has made, it has changed the conversation to a degree. So I'm not that surprised that they would try to shut them out of this meeting.
Well, another thing that I think that is important to mention the Fed doing and why they would be targeted for protests, for example, I mentioned at the top, focusing on their interest rate making capabilities or determining capabilities. But one thing I feel like, I should mention is the fact that the Fed and the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, are both tasked by Congress with jointly deciding if banks are too big to fail. So if they both decide that these living wills that they have to write as a part of Dodd-Frank, if they decide that those are insufficient, they can then start to take steps to break up the banks. And a lot of talk in Washington is that the FDIC has been more enthusiastic about these finding these living wills to be insufficient than the Fed has. So, yeah, I just wanted to mention the fact that it's more than just interest rate stuff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's a critical thing that we're going to see play out over the next several months and years.
I want to turn now to Hillary Clinton. During the primary, she accused Bernie Sanders of focusing too heavily on breaking up the banks, as I just did there. She claimed instead that we should focus instead on the so-called shadow banking system, which refers to financial companies like asset managers and insurance companies that sort of exist outside the purview of major regulators. But you found an event in Philadelphia last month outside the DNC, which seems to suggest that shadow bankers are hashtag ready for Hillary. Can you explain a little bit about this?
Yeah. So, you know, among the many different institutions that would fall under shadow banks are these private equity firms. And one of the biggest is Blackstone. And they're a private equity firm. They also do asset management. They do a lot of real estate. And Tony James is the president of Blackstone, and he's a Hillary supporter. He has hosted Hillary fundraisers at his house. And at the DNC, he hosted this cocktail party event at a very swanky location. It was at the Barnes Foundation. They shut down an art museum, which has priceless works of Impressionist art. And they held this major cocktail event. The interesting thing about it is that Tony James is probably the nation's number one defender of shadow banks in the press. He has called it a, quote, an Orwellian term. He has said that we are not shadow banks. We just engage in market-based financing, I believe is the term that he uses. And that, you know, they provide a valuable service. They create jobs, things of that nature, which is, you know, that certainly is right to make that opinion. But it's directly opposite what Hillary Clinton has been saying to differentiate herself from the Bernie Sanders and pro-reform advocates, saying that we have to go after this system. And so there is a disconnect when this major supporter of hers is the major defender of the shadow banking system.
I know it's obviously very, very early and a little speculative to say, but what do you think that Blackstone would want to see from a Clinton administration?
Well, I think I know what Tony James would want to see from the Clinton administration, and that's a job. He's made no secret of wanting a high-level position in the a Clinton White House. And I have to mention that I don't think I've even written about this, but I was at the Blackstone party. I managed to sneak my way into it. And pretty much every member of the Obama administration's first-term economic team, and I'm talking about Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel and Gene Sperling and several other figures, were at the Blackstone event. And a good number of them are on track to be part of the Clinton administration as well. So this was, a gathering of people who might have major economic policymaking positions in a future Democratic administration, and certainly Tony James is someone who wants to be part of that mix. And there are a lot of things that Blackstone will want. First of all of this talk about, extending the regulatory perimeter to include shadow banks, Blackstone wants no part of that because that would increase scrutiny on them. They would not want to be labeled as a systemically important financial institution. That raises the regulatory bar under Dodd-Frank. It forces them to hold more capital so that they can absorb any losses that they take and that they are less of a risk to the overall financial system. So there are any number of things that a Blackstone would want and personally that a Tony James would want.
You think that Tony James, obviously speculative question again, but do you think that Tony James has a clause in his contract that offers him a bonus for going through the revolving door?
Well, I mean, that sounds probably outlandish to your viewers, but that is a feature of the financial system, that we see this come up time and time again. We've seen individuals receive bonuses for government service, whether it's the acceleration of their stock options or just pure cash. And there is actually a bill in Congress written by Tammy Baldwin that would get rid of this, would ban this practice of golden parachutes for government service. And Clinton has actually herself said that she endorses that, even though two of her members of the State Department, when she was in office, when she was Secretary of State, Thomas Nides and Robert Hormats, received those golden parachutes from Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, respectively, when they went and rotated into government service. Both of them are back out now in the private sector, and Nides, in fact, went right back to Morgan Stanley.
I want to bring up Donald Trump here, since we haven't talked about him yet and we need a ratings bump here. we've seen him on the campaign trail toy with this populist rhetoric, and we even saw a few weeks ago his campaign. He and Paul Manafort managed to sneak into the Republican Party platform, language calling for the return of Glass-Steagall. Now, we know just 2 weeks after that, Trump gave his economic speech in which he called for a moratorium on all regulations, including financial regulations.
So that a disconnect there.
That commitment lasted all of 2 weeks. So I guess my question is, was this just more of sort of the empty populist rhetoric that Trump tries to get across every time? Or is his campaign trying to position itself in this election in some way to the left of Hillary Clinton on banking, even though we haven't seen any proposals really to back it up?
I think it's something of a pose. I mean, it was just sort of a clumsy grab for Bernie Sanders supporters. And then we saw several of those during the RNC when they would just name check certain things that they imagined that the Bernie people would like. In a like clumsy first date bid to try to woo them over, but I don't see it working. Especially since, as you mentioned in the economic speech, they went right back to really conservative orthodoxy. I think the most amusing example of this is Trump's claim that he would lower or eliminate the loophole on hedge funds and how they are taxed. He said that they would, have to claim their income as income instead of as capital gains. And the problem is that he created another loophole within the individual tax system called pass-through income, so that even though he's removing the loophole, the tax rate for hedge fund managers would actually be lower under Trump than it is today. So this is a perfect example of just sort of sleight of hand here. And I really don't think that we'll see a whole lot different coming out of the any kind of Trump administration with respect to financial regulation.
Yeah, I'm curious if Trump even knows what Glass-Steagall means, to be completely honest. But David Dayan, we are fresh out of time. I encourage our listeners to check out his work. You can find it over at The Intercept, at The Fiscal Times, and at The New Republic. And you can follow him on Twitter at DDayan. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Dave.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent, still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Let's move on now to some economic news for the 99%.
As we discussed last week, the Drug Enforcement Administration declined to take marijuana off of its list of Schedule 1 controlled substances, a move that means the federal government will continue to treat marijuana like it's as dangerous as heroin. Although the DEA removed some barriers to studying marijuana for scientific purposes, the move to keep it as Schedule 1 will see continued uncertainty and the continued suppression of the medicinal and recreational industries that have sprouted up in states all over the country. Medicinal marijuana is currently legal in 25 states and Washington, D.C., with an estimated 1.2 million patients. Recreational cannabis usage is decriminalized in 16 states, and smoking pot is fully legal in 4 states and right here in the dirty district, Washington, D.C.
Light them up.
But the federal government remains woefully behind the curve, as demonstrated by the DEA's decision, which was based in part on a study that said marijuana, quote, lacks an acceptable level of safety for use, even under medical supervision.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand through all the square talk you're spitting out there.
I don't get it. Alcohol somehow is safe for use without medical supervision, but not pot. I mean, okay, don't get me wrong. I'm not in favor of banning booze. I'm probably going to drink a lot of it soon.
And you might even injure yourself or someone else.
Well, exactly. That's the double standard here, which is amazing. I mean, if I were a cop wanting to assure safety above all else, I would definitely ban out booze. And not only that, hand out free weed. But that's just me.
The one time when interacting with the police would actually be good.
Yeah, right. Sign me up. I'll support the fraternal order then. Anyway, as we mentioned on Friday, this increasingly retrograde mentality is pervading in Washington, despite the government itself saving money as a result. Research in Health Affairs said that medicinal marijuana is causing Medicare Part D users to turn increasingly away from painkillers and opiates, and that the trend saved taxpayers $165 million in 2013 alone. But it's also important to note what the government is missing out by not fully legalizing, which is what I want to get to today. That same Health Affairs study also found that Medicare Part D, for example, would save an additional $300 million if medical marijuana was available nationwide. So that would have been $465 million in savings in 2013 alone, just from people being able to use cannabis as a painkiller. I mean, that number, that $465 million, could buy the Air Force about 20 F-16s.
I know that'll get Boeing on board.
Yeah.
You know, this is all about coalition building.
Although, you know, people smoking pot might make them less desirous of war. So
that's true.
Who knows? There are competing interests there. Then there's also this about full legalization from the Congressional Research Service, which found that nationwide legalization and a $50 per ounce excise tax would net the U.S. government $6.8 billion in additional revenue alone. That doesn't account for lower spending on law enforcement and prisons and reductions in spending on more dangerous substitutes to marijuana, like opioid painkillers. And by the way, congressional research came up with this number. When it came up with this number, the $6.8 billion, it assumed that legalization would see pot prices fall to between $5 and $18 per ounce.
Jesus.
It's currently between $200 and $300 per ounce, but don't take my word for it. That also came from congressional research.
Yeah, so I heard.
From what I hear, it's pretty accurate. So assuming that there would be full legalization, which is what Bernie Sanders called for in the Democratic primary, by the way, Americans could pay $68 per ounce of marijuana, tax included, and that everyone doing that would net the federal government almost $7 billion per year in just revenue alone. Instead, we get the boneheaded crap we got last week, the DEA keeping it fully illegal by saying that marijuana, quote, lacks an acceptable level of safety for use even under medical supervision. Well, I sure do hope someone files a FOIA for information related to that decision and that report, because my God, what hack science do they rely on? I mean, how can Democrats accuse Republicans of being anti-science on global warming when they say that marijuana isn't even, quote, safe for use under medical supervision, but alcohol is? I mean, it's truly stunning. That was a Department of Health and Human Services report, by the way. If we have any aspiring FOIA request filers listening, or if Jason Leopold is listening to this show.
Can I just comment how the DEA and the Health and Human Services can say that there lacks an acceptable level of safety for use even under medical supervision regarding marijuana, when, yeah, as yeah. we mentioned, more than half the country is currently prescribing medical marijuana to people who are using it.
Yeah.
Like, it just go to one of these states, talk to one of
California,
these people.
California.
You will see that it is being used safely and effectively and saving the government money. Everybody's freaking happy about it.
Yeah.
Anyways, you don't need anyone really to file a FOIA either to see just how dumb and unscientific the government's approach to marijuana is. In fact, why don't we just play a clip from that time the former DEA head, Michelle Leonhardt, got completely and embarrassingly owned by Colorado Democratic Representative Jared Polis. It's my favorite clip. Please play it.
Is crack worse for a person than marijuana?
I believe all illegal drugs are bad.
Is methamphetamine worse for somebody's health than marijuana?
I don't think any illegal drug
is good. Heroin
she's going to get it this time. She'll
for
get it right.
Someone's health than marijuana.
Again,
either yes, no, or I don't know. I mean, if you don't know, you can look this up. You should know this as the chief administrator for the Drug Enforcement Agency. I'm asking you a very straightforward question. Is heroin worse for someone's health than marijuana?
All illegal drugs are bad.
Does this mean you don't know?
Heroin causes an addiction.
Okay.
Marijuana causes the munchies.
By the way, Leonhardt is no longer at the DEA. But her replacement, Chuck Rosenberg, he's just as bad, called the idea of medical marijuana a, quote, joke. Again, more than half the country uses medical marijuana, so, or is allowed to use it. So,
yeah.
Wake the hell up, Chuck.
Yeah, and a lot of people would tell you that it's the most effective and best painkiller that they have. So it's actually really quite offensive to hear him say that, let alone to hear someone who's the head of the DEA say that. But One more point on this before I just say screw it and roll up a blunt. I want to read a recently published quote from former aide to President Nixon, John Ehrlichman, on why the Nixon administration cracked down on marijuana in 1970, which was the first time it was added to the DEA's scheduling. "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news," Ehrlichman also said. "Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did."
Damn, that's like some supervillain stuff right there.
Right, yeah. So, you know, in case you missed it, drugs, including marijuana, probably only made illegal initially to allow the U.S. government to attack anti-war protesters and black people. And it's still just as illegal today as it was then under 1970s under Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Yeah, and that should burn all of us up. Turning now to trade, the White House at the end of last week took the initial step necessary to get Congress to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership as required by the fast-track legislation known as TPA passed last year. The White House submitted a notification to Congress on how it intends to enact the trade deal once it's approved, if it's approved. The notification officially starts the clock for when the administration can submit TPP approval legislation to Congress. Under TPA, once Congress has been notified, the White House must wait a minimum of 30 days for submitting TPP for an up or down vote. Now, no one is expecting Obama to push Congress next month to pass TPP. It's clear that with the election going on, where both candidates are running opposed to TPP, now is not the best time to twist lawmakers' arms to approve the sweeping trade deal. But this move shows that the president is still hell-bent on getting this thing passed, despite the bruising it's received over the last year from members in both parties. And President Obama is clearly eyeing the lame duck session a few weeks after the election in November, but before a new Congress is sworn in January, as the prime window to mount his TPP offensive. In fact, he's called his shot like Babe Ruth. I'm reading from a Politico report last week, quote, "When the dust settles after the election, Obama said he would like to sit down publicly with lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to discuss the actual facts behind the deal rather than toss it around like a political football. The president compared the headwinds the TPP is now facing to the obstacles that fast-track legislation to expedite passage of the trade deal faced last summer. He said, quote, somehow we muddled through and got it done, and I intend to do the same with the actual agreement." Now, despite the president's optimism there, this is going to be an extremely difficult fight. There's fierce opposition to the trade pact on both sides of the aisle, as I mentioned. The left is feeling burned from what previous trade deals have done to labor, destruction of the manufacturing sector. Just look at what Bernie Sanders was saying on the campaign trail. And hell, look at what Donald Trump is saying. It echoes a lot of concerns that people on the left have made. Lawmakers have also raised concerns about the lack of enforceable environmental and labor standards in partnering countries. Plus, there was that whole row over Malaysia, you know, letting a country implicated in human trafficking join the TPP deal. Plus, conservatives have big problems with it, too. They don't think that certain IP protections are long enough for various medicines. They want more assurances that U.S. pork and dairy exports will still have access to foreign markets. And some lawmakers are even pissed, I'm looking at you, Senator Tom Tillis, about tobacco carve-outs that prohibit tobacco companies from using investor-state dispute settlements to sue governments. So look, assuming this isn't all election year bluster that fades away in November, it's safe to bet that it's not, since these problems with the trade deal have long persisted before this election started. The president really does have his work cut out for him to get TPP passed in a lame duck session. Now, I can guarantee you that Hillary Clinton is paying close attention to how President Obama proceeds here, and so too is her running mate, Senator Tim Kaine, who will likely still be in the Senate serving in a lame duck session, whether he wins or loses in this election, and he may have to register a vote on TPP. And he supported TPA, but he claims that he has concerns with TPP in its current form. Clinton, meanwhile, seems to be further solidifying her opposition to the trade deal. In her economic speech last week in Detroit, she said, quote, "I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose it now, I'll oppose it after the election, and I'll oppose it as president." But here's the thing. Does Clinton oppose it enough that she would urge senators to reject it in a lame duck session? Does she oppose it enough to where if President Obama gets it through a lame duck session, that she as president would pull the U.S. from it? So far, we haven't heard her say any of that stuff. She hasn't gone that far, and she likely won't address these sorts of hypotheticals. And really, President Obama doesn't really seem all too concerned by the fact that his potential Democratic successor in the White House is opposed to the deal. He told Politico, quote, "Right now, I'm president, and I'm for it, and I think I've got the better argument." So, folks, stay tuned for what could be an extremely awkward few weeks in December.
Awkward indeed, just the way I like it. One more story here for the People's Bulletin. A federal appellate court in Cincinnati ruled against the FCC last week in a case that will make it more difficult to get high-speed internet into underserved parts of the country. In February last year, the commission had moved to preempt state laws in Tennessee and North Carolina that stop local communities from starting or expanding new government-run internet service providers, so-called municipal broadband. In Tennessee, the laws especially seemed like a shameful favor to telecoms giants by the state legislature, as municipal broadband has already been wildly successful in Chattanooga, and the project's boosters had been looking to expand it to neighboring communities.
And wildly successful, that might actually be an understatement. This thing was revolutionary, what was going on in Chattanooga. The gig, as they called it, yeah. It offered 10 gigabyte connections. That's nearly 1,000 times faster than the average broadband connection in the U.S., It's hard to even conceive of what that means, internet that's 1,000 times faster. And it was offering it to every business and every residence in the city for about $300 a month, which is a little bit hefty, but that's extremely good internet. But you could get cheaper options that were also available, 3 and 5 gigabyte speed connections, in addition to its existing 1 gigabyte service, all of which are still way faster than anything internet companies are offering. And, of course, they're offering it at a much, much lower rate.
Which makes sense that they wanted to expand it to neighboring communities and that neighboring communities would want that service. But as the poets say, nothing gold can stay. Last Wednesday, a 3-judge panel on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed those laws against community broadband in North Carolina and Tennessee, saying that the FCC had acted illegally in trying to nullify them. The judges said in a unanimous ruling that the commission had misinterpreted Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 when issuing its preemption. The FCC can still challenge the decision either by asking for an in-bank ruling, which would involve all judges on the Sixth Circuit, not just a three-judge panel, or by appealing straight to the Supreme Court. Either way, things don't look good for those who think that municipal broadband can bridge the digital divide. FCC Chair Tom Wheeler reacted to the news last week, noting that the commission will, quote, consider all our legal and policy options to remove barriers to broadband deployment, and noted that he personally would be happy to testify in cases challenging anti-competitive broadband statutes. Doesn't exactly sound confident of the decision being reversed.
No, he doesn't at all. And let me just say this to close out the show here. If these internet companies stop me from getting my socialized public internet at 1,000 gigabytes, I'm going to be pretty pissed.
Get ready to be and stay pissed, bud.
Do you know how many episodes? I could download like the entire season of Lost in like a minute.
You
with
know,
my 1,000 gigabytes.
Or you could download good TV shows too. But either way, I'm not sure that it's going to happen.
Yes. Let's see. This is the fight of our lifetimes, folks. That's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to this show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay right here in D.C. so you don't have to be.